Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, May 4th, 2013. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. In the last days, we've had a series of discussions with Lyndon LaRouche in which he's emphasized repeatedly the significance of the Glass-Steagall fight in the United States for the whole world. What he's been saying is that even though in Europe there's a general recognition that the Euro system cannot work. In fact, it's more than a recognition. It's almost an avalanche of data coming in showing the countries that have abided by the European Union prescription and the prescription of the Troika, the European Commission and the IMF, to go with massive austerity even while the banks are bailing out, that in each of those countries, the GDP is collapsing. The standards of living are collapsing. Greece was even declared a violation of human rights law by the UN Human Rights Commission, saying that the austerity regime is killing people, which of course we've said all along. We got a report yesterday from an economist that the economy of Cyprus, following the bail-in robbery of bank deposits combined with austerity, that the Cyprus economy will contract by 60%, that's 60%, over the next 3 years. So it's clear that in Europe, the IMF, EU, ECB system, European Central Bank system of austerity and bailouts will not work. And yet within Europe, what Lyndon LaRouche has emphasized is that the political system does not allow the kinds of changes that our constitutional system in the United States not only allows, but requires to function. And that puts the pressure on the American people to make sure that we get Glass-Steagall, not just for ourselves and not just for Europe, but for the rest of the world and for the future. Now, in that context, we have a week of action coming up next week with mobilization in many state capitals and many cities around the country. You can go to LaRouchePact.com to get the details. And if there's nothing there for your city or your town, call us up at 800-929-7566 to get the details. But we have to have a mobilization in the United States to win this fight. And we're making headway. We're now over 60 co-sponsors of the Glass-Steagall HR 129. We also have now 18 state legislatures which have resolutions for Glass-Steagall, and we need to add more. We're going to be trying in the next week to add California, New York, Texas, minimally, those three states to the list, also Ohio. So there's a lot to do. But then let me just say that on the program today, besides reviewing this difference between the U.S. and Europe and why the U.S. is key, we're also going to take up the deeper question of how is it that policies that kill people are not only going on, but are being allowed at a point when it's clear that these policies don't work. And for that, we're going to be relying on our guests to take us through a discussion of the difference between real environmentalism based on the human creative mind as the central weapon to develop civilization and the solar system, as in the writings of Vladimir Vernadsky, versus the insanity of the so-called environmentalists. And in particular, we may look at an individual in Germany named Schellenhuber, who claims to be a Vernadskian, even as he's destroying the minds of people and destroying the lives of people that supposedly, according to Vernadsky, represent the greatest resource we have. So we'll be discussing the Glass-Steagall fight and the battle against extreme environmentalism. And by extreme environmentalism, I mean the genocidal policies that come out of the British Empire. So joining me today will be an old friend of the program, Bruce Director, who's been on several times. Bruce is involved in the Constitutional Defense Fund, one of the coordinators there, but he's also been working with Lyndon LaRouche for many, many years on science, scientific breakthroughs, and most importantly, understanding the history of science. So Bruce, welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot. Good to be here.
Now, you just came back from the conference we had in Europe, the Schiller Institute conference, where there was an extensive discussion from both Lynn and Helga LaRouche on this question of the problem in Europe. Europe, there's no sovereignty left. There's almost no economy. What is the problem in Europe? Why is it that parliaments, such as the Cyprus parliament, even though it was a close vote, why do they keep voting to kill their people?
Well, the problem you have in Europe is the same one we had in the 1930s, where you have a group of financial interests centered in London, centered around the British monarchy, which really, as LaRouche emphasized over and over again at the conference, is really the British Empire, and that this is something that Europeans and Americans really need to understand. And the British Empire has been progressively imposing on Europe conditions not only of economic hardship, but at the same time of reducing the sovereignty of the individual nations in Europe, which has been the British Empire's goal all along. In fact, it's the British Empire's drive to subjugate continental Europe by various means, which has been really the cause of the wars that have dominated Europe for the last at least 150 years since the sacking of Bismarck in the 1890s.
Isn't it a problem that even though this, what you said, should be very clear, that people deny that there's even a British Empire in operation today?
Well, yes, and part of it is because the British have learned over the years to be a little bit crafty about the way they do things, but it's fairly obvious to anybody who keeps their eyes open. In fact, most reasons why people don't want to face the fact that it's the British Empire is because if they know what it is, then they're fearful of it, and they don't want to really strike at the heart of their problem. In the most recent period, you see it around what led to the development of the euro as the common currency among the 17 nations of the European Union. The European Union itself was taken over by the British. It originally started out as an idea, the common market between France and Germany after the war to facilitate economic development and reconstruction. And initially, the French and the Germans opposed British entry into the EU, but Britain got its fingers into it.
But Britain's not even officially a member of the euro.
Well, this is what I was about to say. What happened is that when the Berlin Wall came down, much to the chagrin of the British Empire, which enjoyed the Cold War as a way to play the West off against the East and to prevent economic development, the British, Margaret Thatcher, representing the British Empire, and Francois Mitterrand, who himself was a British agent going all the way back during his entire career, he at the time was the president of France, imposed conditions on the Germans that if they wanted reunification for their country, they would have to give up their strong currency because it agreed to the development of a common currency, the euro, because the British did not want Germany to become a major industrial power and to make arrangements with Russia. Now, this is really important for our listeners to understand because Lyndon LaRouche was in prison at the time that the wall came down in 1989. But a year before that, he was the very first political leader in either the West or the East who emphatically insisted that the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact was about to collapse because of economic conditions, and that the time had come to actually discuss the unification of Germany, and that the mission of this reunified Germany would be to make an alliance or to develop economic development the entire Eurasian continent, and it is to look east. Now, this is very important because it's precisely this issue of a continental alliance, especially between Germany and Russia, which goes back to the period of the American Civil War, when Lincoln in the North American continent, in addition to winning the war against the British Empire, made America a continental power, following on the ideas of John Quincy Adams. And Bismarck and his allies in Germany, and also American allies in Russia, were at the time collaborating on a Russian-German collaboration to develop the entire Eurasian continent with things like the Trans-Siberian Railroad and large railroad projects and other industrial projects. So the British feared that because as the empire, which gains its power from control of the seas and control of finance and control of insurance and diplomacy, the same way the old Venetian Empire did, the British didn't want these big continental development powers to occur. So they engineered the sacking of Bismarck, and that led to a whole series of events. They got the Japanese to attack Russia. They started Balkan wars. They started one war after another to pick apart and destroy and prevent any attempt for a continental-wide alliance in Eurasia. So LaRouche recognized that the key to not only fighting the British Empire, but to the survival of mankind as a whole, which we can discuss later, depended on actually developing the Eurasian continent as a continental-wide power through collaboration among these nations. And this was on the table in 1989 when the Berlin Wall fell, and we had a great opportunity that had George Bush Sr. not been president, had LaRouche been out of prison, had there been more guts among the German politicians and less corruption in Russia, and people had listened to LaRouche, we would have had a much different world today. We would have had a peaceful cooperation on economic development among Germany, Russia, later China, India, the other Eastern European countries, France, Italy would get involved in it.
You know, I think it's important to note that given what you just said, that we had two world wars in the 20th century that came out of the deployment to defend the British Empire. And as in the case of all empires in history, the empire's main concern is self-preservation. And the British realized after World War II they couldn't continue to dominate in the same way. But one of the things they're doing now, one of the keys to this current situation, is the destruction of national sovereignty, isn't it?
Exactly. And that's what happened. If you the two world wars that we had in the 20th century and the danger of a third world war have all been over the very same issue, this issue of economic and technological development for mankind versus the British Empire's attempt to try and maintain themselves in an imperial system which requires that they reduce the world's population, that they maintain most of the population in a state of intellectual and physical deprivation, and that they prevent any people anywhere on the planet from organizing themselves into a nation which will defend its sovereignty and defend its principles of growth, which its highest expression comes in the United States. And this is really the issue. And the problem we have in world politics today is that both policymakers, outside of a few, and the population in general is ignorant of this history. The time frame of development, the time frame that people think of in their minds, is very short, usually just a few weeks, at best maybe a lifetime. But you know, when you think about it, the period of 120, 130, 150 years is absolutely nothing in the development of human history. And you have to understand the events as they're unfolding today from the standpoint of these historical processes which have been underway for quite some time. And what happened at the end of 1989 is that the British said, okay, the way we're going to prevent this now is we're going to impose on Germany and on Europe this single currency, the euro. Germany will have to give up its Deutschmark, which was the most important thing, and other countries especially, they had to get France to agree. So now you have 17 nations which have adopted a currency which they don't control. It's controlled by some vague thing called the European Union. There's a central bank called the European Central Bank. Each country has its own central banks. So now you have a bifurcation of the economic policy that a nation needs to carry out in its own best interests versus a dictatorship which is exercised out of Brussels, and the European Central Bank is headquartered in Frankfurt, which then dictates policy. And the important thing, as you mentioned, is that the British themselves have not imposed on themselves, on the United Kingdom, the very conditions that they demand the rest of Europe do. And so what happens is that the Britain still has the pound, and the City of London is still the financial center, which controls the currency, and yet all these countries have to obey what the British want to do. So
now, Bruce, let me just ask you this, because as you go through this, one of the questions that comes up is that there was opposition to this policy as it was unfolding, and there was also an alternative. LaRouche, back at the time of the, and especially Helga Zepp LaRouche, at the time of the collapse of the Soviet Union, offered an alternative based on the idea of the Eurasian land bridge. But here you see the other side of the British Empire. There were a series of assassinations of German leaders who were close to Helmut Kohl, the chancellor at the time, and Kohl was essentially told, either you go along with this or you're next.
Well, that's a very important point. And that's the British always, they get their way, or they've gotten their way, because they use a political pressure. But then when the political pressure fails, they pull out the guns and they start assassinating leaders or sacking them, like they did with Bismarck in 1890. But you could see the effect of the euro today. You could see the fallacy. And I should say that Helga LaRouche and Lyndon LaRouche both said in the late 1990s, when the euro was coming into existence, that it was a failed experiment. It would never work. It would fail. Meanwhile, the British pushed the line, which a lot of fools in Europe believed, that this was wrong because it was the dollar that was actually going to fail, and that the euro would be the strong currency of the world, and the euro would eventually be able to replace the dollar as the world reserve currency, because all these European countries would be happy to work together, and they would combine the different strengths of the different countries and counterbalance the weaknesses. And then this big European currency block would be able to become the world economic powerhouse.
Well, they did rig the euro for a period of time, because it opened at less than $1 per euro, and now it's $1.30 per euro. So even with the euro in a complete state of in its death throes, it's still maintaining a very high level to the dollar, which obviously reflects the effect of the speculators and the bailouts.
Well, yeah, and that's the decision that's been made. This is how these speculators decide to, make trillions of dollars, and by speculating on these point spreads between these currencies and manipulating them. But to make it clear to people, just look at the current situation. Here you have a country like Cyprus or a country like Greece, which have completely different economies. First of all, their economic development in the last 20 years or so has been suppressed. You take Greece, which has agriculture, it has potential for a lot of mining, it has a tremendous natural resource base, which most people don't know, which has always been contested by the great powers. It has a shipbuilding industry, it has other industries, potential for economic industrial development, and yet over the last 20, 25 years, especially over the last 20 years since the euro came in, Greece has been designated to not be an industrial power on the part of the EU, but to be a tourist destination and a service industry, and to make its funds, make its money, and its economy, base its economy on tourism and services. And as a result, the Greek economy doesn't have the kind of depth it needs to sustain its population. So you get into a debt crisis, and Greece now is, borrowed money because its economy was not big enough to sustain it, which the banks in Germany and London and the United States, especially the European banks, were quite willing to do. So they indebted the country. But because they had the euro currency, they had an illusion that they somehow had money, because their currency was equal to the same currency they had in Germany. So this debt crisis blew up. And then when it blew up, instead of trying to protect the people of Greece, the European Union, the IMF, and the European Central Bank go in to Greece and arrange a deal where they make money available to the Greek government to pay the banks in exchange for the Greek government imposing massive austerity against its population. And I would recommend that our listeners go to the Schiller Institute website, newparadigm.schillerinstitute.com, to see some of the speeches that were given at the European conference. And I highly recommend a speech by the Greek representative there, Dr. Katsanevos, who is a well-known economics professor in Greece. And he showed at the beginning of his presentation a short 5-minute, 10-minute film, which said, look, Greece is the cradle of Western civilization. European civilization arose from Greece. And now you have, in the name of Europe, something being imposed on Greece, which is absolutely horrific. And this, the film was very heart-wrenching and showed that, you know, the conditions of life that are being imposed on the Greek people are appalling.
Well, and this is what the point Mr. LaRouche was making, is that within Europe, despite the obvious nature now of the failed policies, there's not a possibility for change. Now, you're listening to The LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, May 4th, 2013, and we're hearing from Bruce Director, who just came back from a major conference in Europe. So, Bruce, what is different about the United States? Why is it that Glass-Steagall is possible here, whereas at this point, politically, it's not possible in Europe?
Well, this is very important for Americans to understand. And LaRouche, in the last couple weeks, has really been emphasizing this and saying that America is really called to a mission again. It's a mission that we've had throughout our history. The people came to the United States in the 18th century as part of a mission to build a nation and a society which was based on economic sovereignty and the freedom of the population to develop and to do the good. And the intention was that by establishing that here in North America, we would create enough, we would create a basis by which we could free Europe from what really are the vestiges of the imperial system, the Roman imperial system. Europe as a continent has been dominated by empires for the last 2,000 years, really ever since the Peloponnesian Wars. It just changed its name. You had the Roman Empire, Byzantine Empire, the Holy Roman Empire, the Venetian Empire. These are just imperial systems, and they dominate Europe. And when you look at the European political systems, you see that they are not republican systems like the United States, which, as Lincoln said, is organized as a government for, by, and of the people. But they are whatever exists in terms of political freedom or political power in the hands of the population are really just concessions by the imperial powers to allow a little bit of a veneer, an appearance of democracy in government formed by and of the people. But it's not really a real government like we have.
But you see, most people don't believe that in the United States now. They say it's that things are just as controlled here as in Europe, and you can't change anything.
Well, they're controlled here, but not for the same reasons. They're controlled here largely because the American people have voluntarily given up, out of their own stupidity, the control they actually have over the government. And of course, LaRouche PAC and our movement is trying to rally people to take it back. But in Europe, they don't have that possibility. For example, you have a party system in Europe, and this shows you how we've degenerated, because we've tended to adopt this, especially in the last 15 years, where in Europe, in European parliaments, everything is done by the party. So if you're a member of parliament and you're in the majority party of the government, you have to vote the way the government wants you to vote, because if you can effectively defeat your own party's policy, then your party's government will fall. if you're in the opposition, you can vote against the government, but it won't mean anything because you know you're going to lose from the beginning. So how do you talk to a parliamentarian in a European parliament and get them to vote on principle when if they take a principle position, either the government will fall or it will be meaningless?
We've seen this in Greece where there has been opposition and it never gets to the threshold of change.
Well, you have to add an additional layer, which is that you've had because of the euro and the EU policies and the British policies, European governments have ceded their own sovereignty, their own decision making, to this supranational bureaucracy headquartered in Brussels, which is really controlled out of London, and they don't control it. I mean, and this is, you know, all Europeans complain about this, and when you go to Europe, you see it very clearly that everything that happens in the European economies are dictated by regulations that come out of Brussels. I mean, you know, such things as, you know, what is the proper size of a tomato? You know, this is the if you look at the amount of regulation and dictates that are coming out of Brussels that reach into every nation. And so governments are told, well, we may not want to do this in our country, but the EU says we have to do it if we're going to stay members of the EU. So we have to conform our policy to what the EU says. So now you get a crisis like this, and you take the Cyprus thing. The EU dictated that this bail-in policy of Cyprus, which remember originally was a huge tax on all deposits in these two banks in Cyprus. And it was a huge outcry in Cyprus, which is a very small country. They have, 700,000 people, I think, at most. You know, it's the size of a large American city. And people of Cyprus objected. The entire parliament voted unanimously to reject the EU demands. And then the EU came in and said, well, that's very nice that you voted this way, but we'll tweak the policy a little bit. We won't confiscate bank accounts less than 100,000, and you have to go along with this policy, and you don't even need to take it to Parliament at all. So the Parliament voted against the policy. The EU came in and said, well, sorry, your Parliament might have voted against the policy, but we're going to impose it anyway. And that's what happened. So they taxed the deposits over 100,000. They say they're not taxing deposits under 100,000, but they imposed currency controls and withdrawal restrictions so that you may have less than 100,000 in the bank and your money might not have been confiscated, but you can't get it out. So that's effectively been confiscated. So
the same provision exists under the FDIC, under the Dodd-Frank rule, under the so-called bank resolution laws that would allow a so-called bail-in to occur in the U.S.
Absolutely, and here's the rub, which I think EIR's economics editor Paul Gallagher pointed out so clearly, which is that in the United States and under the FDIC, deposits over a certain amount are not guaranteed. But when a bank is bankrupt, what the U.S. policy has been up till now is that you shut the bank down. And when you shut the bank down, you sell off the assets. The federal government guarantees the depositors under a certain amount, and what's ever left over, you distribute according to the priority, which may include some money for depositors over the limit, as well as, you know, usually nothing for the stockholders and the bondholders. So you shut the bank down and put it through bankruptcy and liquidate it. In the Dodd-Frank case and in the Cyprus case, the policy is that we don't shut the banks down. So if you're going to keep a bankrupt institution functioning open, then the only way you can do that is to steal the money from the depositors.
Now, Bruce,
in the Dodd-Frank that you've created a mechanism by which a insolvent financial institution can be kept running without a government bailout is a fraud, because the bailout is going to come from the depositors and from the people. And that's why we have to get Glass-Steagall, because Glass-Steagall has a separation between the commercial banks and the speculative investment banks. And then if a bank gets in trouble, you shut it down. That's what you do with a bankrupt corporation. You put it through bankruptcy, you sell off the assets, and you distribute the proceeds according to a priority which every investor and depositor knows in advance. So if you have Glass-Steagall, you walk into a bank and you say the limit in the United States is $250,000. You open a bank account and it says, okay, your money up to $250,000 is guaranteed by the government, and anything you put in this bank over $250,000 is at risk. We'll pay you a higher interest rate, but you're going to lose it. And you tell people that ahead of time, and everybody knows the rules. And then when the bank goes bankrupt, you implement the rules. That's the only way you can do business.
Well, Bruce, the thing I want to get to now so we can shift directions a little bit is that a lot of people hear what you've been describing for the last half hour and say, yeah, these guys are crooks, they're thieves, they want to make money, they don't care about us, all of which is true. But there is a higher intent to their policy. And I think this is, just as people don't understand what the British Empire is, they don't understand how the empire works. It's not just about thievery and pageantry, but there's another side to it. And I'd like you to get to that now, this whole question of that LaRouche has identified, that the intent of the empire is to kill off the world's population.
Absolutely, and they need to kill off the world's population because their imperial system depends on maintaining a imperial structure, maintaining an imperial structure, which is a fixed structure, a fixed form of society. It's not that hard for our listeners to understand this, because even if you know very little about history, you all know, most people know how the feudal system worked in Europe or how the imperial system of Greece worked. It basically, everybody was in their place. If you were a farmer, you were a farmer. If you were a craftsman, you stayed a craftsman. Your son became a craftsman. Your grandson became a craftsman. Everybody was chained to the land. There was a ruler, a small ruler over you, a prince or a duke or some minor nobility over you. And over the minor nobility was the middle nobility, and over the middle nobility were kings and queens, and over the kings and queens was an emperor. And everybody had to obey the rules of the imperial system and keep everything fixed. And you could only change that with permission of the emperor. Now, the problem with the imperial system is that it goes against the actual physical characteristics of mankind, of living processes, and of the universe as a whole. If you look at the history of the evolution, for example, of the Earth, and the evolution of the solar system, and even now we can speak, not, you know, completely, but with some confidence about the evolution of galaxies over the last 30, 40, 50 years. We have scientific data which allow us to speak confidently about, knowledgeably about the development of galaxies. You see that the universe is characterized by a different process in which things are not fixed. There isn't a budgeting of energy where if energy is expended in one place, it's at the expense of energy in another place. There's actually a tendency for the universe to evolve from lower to higher states of organization. You see this with galaxies in terms of the type of self-organization of galaxies. You see this with what we now know about the development of our solar system from a spinning plasma disk into a harmonically ordered system of planets. You see this with the development of Earth, on the development of the Earth, in which life as a force becomes a factor in the development of the Earth, and we look at the evolution of life, and you see that it goes from simple organisms and simple forms of life to more complex forms of life, and ultimately to the evolution of human life, which possesses something that no other form of life has, which is creative thought. So human society must be organized consistent with that tendency, and that means that human society must be organized around the creative powers of the human mind, because when you look at the development of the economy and the development of human beings, we're the only creature that not only possesses creativity, but our existence depends on creativity. We cannot maintain a fixed relationship to our environment. We have to keep changing our environment by discovering new ideas about how the universe works, how living processes works, and new ideas about how our minds work. And we evolve new concepts, and these concepts increase the power of mankind in and over nature, and increase the power of every individual as well as mankind as a whole. So the United States was founded by people who understood this, and they created a system of government which actually reflects this. Not merely in terms of the structure of the government, which is different than European parliaments, but a structure with a president and a Congress that are independent of each other, and a judiciary and no party system and all those things, which are brilliant. But really, it's embedded in the preamble of the Constitution, which defines the purpose of the government to be to promote the general welfare and to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. That is, the purpose of our actions today is to improve the future.
Well, the argument that the environmentalists put forward is that the general welfare is not served by a growing population because it increases the demand for use of resources, use of land, and so on, and therefore you have to have a reduction of population.
Right, and that's just a total fraud. That's just like Hitler saying that, you know, I have to invade Czechoslovakia because I need more land for the German-speaking population. I need Lebensraum. I mean, you know, these guys make this argument, but it's not a very scientific one. And when you take a look at the actual scientific writings of the that underlay those political pronouncements, you see that they're all fraudulent. And take the example which we indicated at the beginning of the show, the case of this guy Hans Joachim Schellnhuber, who is the head of Climate Research Association in Germany. He's an advisor to the German government.
He's accepted by the establishment as a competent, legitimate scientist.
Oh, yes. He has all the credentials, not only scientific credentials, but the Queen of England made him a commander of the British Empire. And I think that should tell our listeners something. I mean, he's not a friend of the British government or a friend of the people of the United Kingdom. He's a commander of the British Empire. That's what she designated him as.
That's pretty explicit.
Yeah. So, you know, why do they, people say the British Empire doesn't work. Well, why do they have commanders of the British Empire?
So what is Schellnhuber calling for?
Well, he's over the years devised or advocated a policy that we should again limit the sovereignty of nations, and nations must cede their sovereignty to international institutions, and those international institutions should come up with policies which would be mandatorily followed by everybody on Earth, according to what he defines as being the sustainability of the planet. Now, let's just step back for a second. Schellnhuber believes and argues that when we look at the policy for man, for society, for economy, you have to take the entire planet as a whole. Okay, that's legitimate. So far, so good. This was also understood by the great Russian biogeochemist Vladimir Vernadsky, whose 150th anniversary of his birth we're celebrating this year. And the latest issue of 21st Century has a wonderful series of articles discussing Vernadsky and his accomplishments.
Now, what is Vernadsky's background?
Well, Vernadsky is very interesting because he was a student of Mendeleev, the great chemist, which most people know as the founder of the discoverer of the periodic table. Mendeleev, by the way, was also one of the leading collaborators in the post-Lincoln period with the American idea of economics, and was one of the instigators of the Transcontinental Railroad. So Vernadsky was very much involved in his early days with the development of Russia as a continental power, and also trying to get collaboration with France and Germany in that regard. Vernadsky was a brilliant scientist, and really sort of forged a whole new approach to earth sciences by recognizing in a very detailed way the kind of general, the things that I was discussing generally a few moments ago, that if we're going to understand anything about the earth, we have to look at the earth as a whole, and not just the earth as a whole on the earth, but how it interacts in the solar system and beyond, and look at it from the standpoint of the interaction of living processes with the earth, on the earth. So over time, you see that living processes actually are responsible for determining the composition of the soils, of the atmosphere, this kind of thing.
Now, Bruce, is this something that's generally, I assume in the 19th century, with the establishment of the agricultural schools in the United States, the role of Liebig in Germany, that some of this, what you're talking about, was common knowledge among scientists?
Well, there was a tendency in that direction, but Vernadsky is the first one to actually put it together as a science. In other words, people had recognized that man, that this interaction of living processes with the earth was a very complex and understandable process. But Vernadsky is the first one to actually put it together as a whole picture. He did, you know, fascinating empirical studies where he just did a lot of very, very detailed work where he'd go out and examine the chemical compositions of soils and in very great detail, both in terms of the fine details of the chemical compositions, the handedness of crystals, the isotopic compositions, and so forth, to really show how so much of the Earth's crust, an increasing proportion of the Earth's crust, is being transformed by the action of living processes, both microscopic living processes as well as larger living processes. In fact, he coined the term biosphere as the portion of the Earth's crust and atmosphere, the zone, which is actually increasingly dominated by the action of life. And then Vernadsky identified a higher, still higher zone, which is the part of the Earth which is increasingly subjected to the action of human thought, noos meaning the Greek word for mind, and he coined this term noosphere. And so he said that he indicated that what you actually have is that man, the power of the human mind, through the application of science and technology and ideas, is actually becoming, as he called it, a great geological force. And that if we're going to understand the mind, understand the earth, and understand its relationship in the solar system and beyond, we actually have to look at this, the role of the human mind. Now, he understood the mind, the noosphere, as being the effect of human discoveries of science and technology in transforming the earth to higher states of existence, which making it possible to sustain a larger population with a growing dominance over the planet. Now, Vernadsky was not an economist, so he missed several things, not because of ignorance, but because he wasn't really focused in that direction. But LaRouche has supplied those ideas, which is that the development of the noosphere itself, you can actually measure by an increase in the concept of potential relative population density, which is a measure of the power of man in and over the universe, and also by the idea of energy flux density, the density of energy available to each individual member of society. So any successful economy, let's put it even more directly, for man to survive as a species, we have to see an increase in our potential relative population density and an increase in our energy flux density. Put it in general terms, we have to see an increase in the level of science and technology and the power of ideas of society as a whole and of the individual members of society. Now, on the other hand, if you have a society that, in order to have a society that increases its potential relative population density and increases its energy flux density, the society has to be free. It has to be a government like the United States. Sovereign nations governed by, for, and of the people, whose purpose is to improve and foster and develop the creative powers of the human mind. That you can't have in an imperial system. The imperial system can only survive if it can keep things fixed, and the only way to keep things fixed is to keep people stupid and keep people behaving like cattle. And if you do that to any society, and history shows this is true, you don't get an increase in energy flux density, you don't get an increase in potential relative population density, and your economy is characterized by these booms and busts. You get a limit. You grow to a certain level, and then you have a collapse, either due to disease or famine or some breakdown in society. Population goes down, then it goes up, and then it goes down, then it goes up, then it goes down. But so it oscillates in a very small range. But what stays the same is the imperial system. So because of the development of the United States and because of the success that the United States has had in leading the world for economic development over the last 230 years, the human population has grown to 8 billion people. And this, and our power in and over nature has grown, despite everything the British Empire has done. So the British want to get back to a level of population which will sustain an empire. And in order to do that, it's they estimate, by their own admissions, you have to get the population down to between 1 and 2 billion people. So that means 6 billion people have to be eliminated from this planet. And there's no way you can do that without war, famine, and disease, as Bertrand Russell said.
Well, in that, from that standpoint, then you look at the policy toward Greece, where we're seeing an increase in the death rate. You look at what's going to happen in the United States as Obamacare is increasingly implemented, and you see that this is not an accident or a coincidence or the result of bad policy, but you're saying it's the intent.
It's absolutely the intent, because the intent is to maintain the empire. That's the intent. And you cannot maintain a global imperial system unless you reduce the population, and you can't do that except by war, famine, and disease.
Well, let's get into one aspect of that then, because what you laid out earlier is that the basis for the increase in population over the last centuries has been scientific discoveries, innovation, and so on. So why can't the empire use scientific discoveries to keep their power?
Well, that's the problem, because people, by their very nature, are creative. I mean, this has been the argument in human society, you know, probably forever, but we know it for sure over the last 2,500, 3,000 years. Plato is discussing this in the Republic and in his writings. How do you get an organization of society which fosters the creative powers of the human mind when the creative powers of the human mind are voluntary? So Plato struggles with that in the Republic. He tries to come up with some principles which we follow today, but he misses certain things. Nicholas of Cusa in the Renaissance period solved some of the problems that Plato ran into. I guess one of the best ways to pose the problem is the way Cusa did, which is that the best form of government is based on the consent of the government, but the number of fools is infinite. So if you're going to give people the freedom to be creative, there's also a freedom that they'll do something stupid. So society has to be led not by imperial rules and decrees and orders, but it has to be led by leaders who can inspire the population and inspire people to their higher principles. And that's why, for example, Shelley, the great English poet, said poets are the unacknowledged legislators of the world. And if you look at the great leaders of the United States, they've had a certain poetic quality, Lincoln being the epitome of it, but even Franklin Roosevelt or Kennedy, who inspired the American people to and ignited the passions of the people to dedicate their lives to producing a better future. And the problem, you can't do that in the imperial system. You can't go to the people and say, we're going, you know, I want to inspire you to a better future, because in the imperial system, the future is the same as the present and the past. So you have to tamp down those passions and inspirations. And this is where really the question of that the most important thing that governs the direction of an economy is the culture of people. And over the last 40, 50, 60 years, you can even see this in the United States, but just generally, the culture of our society has degenerated to the point where people have less and less passion to make the future better, and more passion associated with soothing the pain of the present, because you are in desperation that the future will be no different than the present or the past.
Well, now, isn't that, when you look at the essence of what the effect of what Schellenhuber is doing, you look at Germany now, which is on a anti-nuclear policy, even though Germany still retains somewhat of its productive economy, it's not going to be able to sustain that. So what is the future under a Schellenhuber reduction of the energy flux density of society?
Yeah, and that's what you see in Germany. That, you know, and this is also, I should point out, why what we've been saying in LaRouche Pack about the effect of youth unemployment is so important. Because if you look at this economic crisis, one of the things that is always increasing, is not only persistent but is increasing, is the unemployment and underemployment of the young population. And that right there is your future. If you take the in any society, the people between 18 and 30 years old, this is the period when, after someone's had supposedly an education, they go out into the world and begin to make a develop their capability to do something with their life to improve the future for future generations. And we're taking an entire generation in some countries like Spain and certain parts of the United States, more than half the population, the young population, and throwing them off on the scrap heap. You're throwing away the future. And you see this in Germany. You see it in European countries. We've seen it for decades now in Asia and Africa. And this really is should give everybody pause, that this imperial British Empire should be overthrown, and we have to get back to the principles of the American Revolution, because the thing we need to be concerned about is not merely the effects of this crisis on people today, which is horrific enough, but that we are making it impossible to ever get out of it in the future. And that's exactly what the British want.
Now, Bruce, where can people find information on Vernadsky? I know we have several things on our website, but where, if someone wants to take a look at this question of energy flux density and the relationship of creativity to human development, where do they go?
The very best place is the 21st Century Science and Technology magazine. Unfortunately, I don't know the exact URL for their website, but if you go to the Google and you Google 21st Century Science and Technology magazine, the latest issue, which is up there, is dedicated to Vernadsky, and I read most of it last night, and I just can't recommend it highly enough for a really good overview of Vernadsky's work.
We have just about 5 minutes to go. I'd like you to just then connect the Vernadsky work to Lyndon LaRouche's initiatives back from the late 70s on the SDI, and today the Russians embracing LaRouche's basic concept with the strategic defense of Earth. Does that come out of Vernadsky, that tradition in Russian science?
Well, sure. You know, if you look at the history of the United States and Russia and the Russian people, you get something that is quite important in terms of human development over the last 300 years. It's something which people in the United States and Russia also don't really know that much about, and it's been pretty much obscured by the because of the Cold War, which the British wanted to obscure. But when you look at the history, Russia really has been one of America's strongest allies, which is kind of ironic because Russia itself has gone through a big turmoil, a conflict between their own imperial powers and a countervailing tendency in Russia, which, you know, you see expressed as far back as Peter the Great, to modernize and westernize and be science, and have a scientific progress. So Russia itself has sort of always had two traditions. One is this imperial tradition, which tried to maintain everything fixed and backward, versus this scientific tradition. And this was true all the way through Russian history, including the Soviet period. But if you look at Catherine the Great, who refused to back the British and the American against the American Revolution, you look at Alexander II, who defended Lincoln, you look at the post-Civil War period, Russia, this scientific tradition in Russia has always resonated with the United States, and there's always been collaboration. Today, LaRouche tried to revive that in the 1980s, 70s and 80s, by proposing that Russia, at that time under the Soviet Union, and the United States collaborate for the common interests of mankind in what he called the Strategic Defense Initiative, which was a program to deploy the scientific resources of both countries to both end the threat of nuclear war, but also develop advanced technologies more broadly in the economy. And today, this same process is expressed by what's called the Strategic Defense of Earth, that is to get the United States and Russia to collaborate on developing the most advanced technologies to defend the Earth from asteroids, the threat of asteroids, and extraterrestrial threats. But the important point is that, as Vernadsky said, you have to look at the Earth as a whole, and you can't then, in order to do that, the Earth, we have different cultures, you need different cultures. We need to foster, we need to preserve the benefits that we have of different cultures, different languages, different histories among people. But we can collaborate. These different cultures can come together and bring the greatest benefits of each one into a common effort to for the common interests of mankind. And that's what LaRouche was talking about with the SDI. And now the Russians are proposing with the Strategic Defense of Earth. And this would mean the end of the British Empire. And this is what the British Empire fears. So what they're trying to do is to get countries like the United States and Russia and other countries to get into conflicts and wars with each other rather than combining our efforts in the common interest of mankind. And that common interest of mankind is the dissolution of the British Empire, the firm establishment of a system of sovereign nation states who collaborate to create a future for the human race.
Well, the most important thing people can do right now is join our week of action this next week, because the fight to get Glass-Steagall through the U.S. Congress before there's another derivatives blowout or another popping of the stock market, which, you know, we're just one bad bet away from seeing the whole thing blow up. And under those circumstances, it would unleash such chaos and misery in the United States that you'd begin to see the genocidal effects of what's been put in place start to take off. So I would urge our listeners to think through these deep ideas that Bruce has presented today on the scientific basis for understanding both the intent of the empire, which is the intent of Barack Obama. He's not one of us. He's not for us. He's just a puppet for this empire. But once you understand that, you should recognize that to unleash the kind of creative explosion of economic activity that Bruce was discussing, the first step is Glass-Steagall. And you can call our number again, 800-929-7566, to see what you can do during the week of action, and go to the 21st Century Magazine that Bruce mentioned with the Vernadsky. And Bruce, I'd like to thank you for joining us. It was sort of last minute notification, but thank you very much.
My pleasure. I enjoyed it.
Okay, and join us next week, Saturday, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for the next edition of The LaRouche Show.